The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Well, a British investigation has linked Russian President Vladimir Putin to the murder of Alexander Litvinenko. He's the one that fled Russia for Britain back in 2000 after a falling out with his FSB bosses in Moscow. And then he was murdered in 2006. He died in London after drinking a cup of green tea that had been laced with poison. And now this conclusion to a years-long investigation linking Russian President Vladimir Putin to the assassination. No word yet on whether British lawmakers will take up a debate on whether or not Putin should be banned from traveling to the UK, but we'll keep you posted on that in case they do. Robert Morley has a great article today featured on the front page of thetrumpet.com, Drunk on Debt, the Anheuser-Busch buyout or takeover of its main competitor, SAB Miller, and he gives some important facts of this merge at the start of his article. Most notably that Budweiser secured a $75 billion loan in order to buy its rival. $75 billion that they loaned to make this work. And as Robert brings out in his article, this represents the biggest corporate loan in the history of the world. That's what we're seeing. That's what we're witnessing. Of course, people at Anheuser-Busch are probably excited, ecstatic to buy out the rival. But is this such a good thing? Robert talks about just the trend in the world economy with these big corporations. Last year, he says that for the first time ever, global mergers and acquisitions, it surpassed $5 trillion, these transactions. And he said this is the third year in a row that there have been increases. So you look at all of these huge mergers and takeovers, and, well, you could just assume that the world economy is humming right along. But as Robert brings out in the article, you just have to look at a little bit of history. What was happening before the crash of 2000? What happened before the crash of 2008? Well, you had these massive corporate merges, these massive spending sprees, right before those crashes. And here we are, 8 years later, in the midst of yet another wild spending spree. Yet another debt party. History repeats itself, as we'll note with these first couple of stories that I'll go through today. But in the case of this article by Robert Morley, we're seeing history repeat itself after just a few years. After just 6 or 7 or 8 years. Robert writes, "Never before has America's central bank so overtly manipulated markets. Never before has America printed up so much money from nothing. Never before have interest rates been artificially suppressed so low and for so long. Never have markets so hinged on the whims of central planners." That's quite a few unprecedented developments. You'd think there'd be more voices calling for us to hit the pause button and to at least consider our ways, to consider where this is leading. and to maybe go back and look at the trends before 2008, just 8 years ago, or the year 2000. Instead, though, as he brings out in his piece, the party just continues. A $75 billion loan that so-called rebound from 2008, which the Obama administration is out there saying, hey, everything's great. We've fully recovered. We're well on our way. Robert says in the article that what rebound there's been is just due to the manipulating of the system by taking on more debt, printing more dollars, borrowing more money. He says, after 30 years of generally falling interest rates and 7 consecutive years of zero-bound interest rates, the whole economy is dependent on something that can't possibly continue. Artificially low interest rates and continually expanding debt loads. Well, the Fed's already made a move to increase the interest rates just by a tiny 0.25%, but still, look at the direction. I mean, it can't stay down there at zero forever. It can't stay that low forever. And how much longer can we continue to take on expanding debt loads? At the end of his piece, Robert writes, this next economic collapse is going to be much harder on Americans because debt levels are so much higher. See, that's the thing. History keeps repeating itself. But the stakes just keep getting higher and higher because we're taking on just these incomprehensible levels of debt. Eye-popping numbers. How can a company, just one corporation, no matter how big it might be, take on a $75 billion loan? Well, they may be partying at Anheuser-Busch. But you look at the broader trends in America's economy today, and as he said, the next economic collapse, it's going to be much worse. Now, you look at this other piece here from the Washington Times. This is by Eric Wilson from January 19th, and the title of his article is 2016's Resemblance to 1937. He says there's lots of writers, commentators, drawing comparisons between what's happening now to 2008 or 1999 and 2000. But he suggests that we go back a little bit further. He says, looking at economic indicators in current conditions confirms a recession is inevitable. It's not that the experts are entirely wrong about 2016. It's just that they fail to see the larger cycle that may exist and the bigger problem that may be looming. If you want to understand what may be coming and learn from history, we need to go back further than 2008 and first look at 1937. And so he gives a bit of history in this article and talked about how America coming out of the Great Depression was in the midst of a rapid recovery. This was during President Roosevelt's first term in office. And then the economy faltered in early 1937. And Wilson writes here, at the time of that recession, there were large imbalances of power and indifference was rampant. Liberties deteriorated, not because of FDR, but because of a culture that accepted it. He says the period started with a major economic collapse. The disaster elicited a mix of apathy and anger, kept at bay by paralysis. There began the general feeling that the culture was heading into peril, and things built to an ultimate climax in 1941. He says the actual lessons of Roosevelt's recession are much different than many of the history books. It says the 1937 dip was not the product of tight fiscal and monetary policy, but of excessive government regulation, and loose monetary policy, but more importantly, a reflection of the culture, people, and attitudes of the time. And then notice what he says here. In those days of 1937, Americans saw unprecedented overreach of government, increased taxes and stagnant growth, unrest and instability abroad, and an underestimation of potential problems. The climax was not the recession of 1937, but the years that followed that enveloped us in World War II, which claimed more than 400,000 U.S. casualties. And so he's saying what many are saying will happen in 2016, what many are predicting, they're probably right. But he's saying, forget about 2016. What about 2020? What about 2019 and 20 and 21? We're repeating history, he says. The history that led up to the last great worldwide war. That's what he's saying. That we're not learning from the past. We're reliving it. We're not learning from the mistakes of the past. We're living it again. Many of the same phenomena and sentiments of 1937, he writes, are playing out today, and we're heading full steam towards similar consequences. And then toward the end of his article, he talks about how we've progressed past the point of no return. Where have you heard that term before? We've passed the point of no return. And then finally, history is repeating itself. I'm less worried about the recession of 2016 than I am the reset of 2020. So you're seeing this in quite a few articles. This is the 1930s again. This is 1937. This is 1938 or 1939. Well, keep moving forward with it, as he does in this article. What happens when we get to 2018, 19, and 20? He brings out, well, I read through the quote earlier, all the unrest and instability abroad. And then switching back to Robert Morley's piece, the stakes being so much higher today because the debt levels are so much higher. And then you add to that, as Wilson brings out, all the unrest and instability around the world. That makes this time period we're in now far more dangerous than 2008 or the year 2000. Unrest, instability, war, rumors of war, to quote what it says in Matthew 24. Tom Coughlin had a piece at the Times today pointing out how Iran will use its new riches. It's just receiving all these tens of billions of dollars now that the sanctions have been lifted. And it's going to be sending that money, much of it, to its military. The 200-page proposal for next year's government budget put before the Iranian parliament this week includes a 15% increase in funding for the Revolutionary Guards and a 50% increase for intelligence services. The conventional Iranian military will also see its funding increase by 16% if the budget is approved. So just to recap, 16% increase for the conventional Iranian military, 15% increase for the Revolutionary Guards, and then a 50% increase for the intelligence services. Iran, surprise, surprise, is using all this money it's receiving to build up its military strength. And this is only going to add to the unrest and instability all across the Middle East. And of course, all throughout Europe as well. Europe is suffering because of the unrest and instability and turmoil in the Middle East and North Africa. The IMF came out with its forecast for migrants entering into the continent, Europe. And over the course of 2015, 16, and 17, they're predicting 4 million migrants. This is a bigger forecast than what was previously suggested by the EU. 4 million, we're right in the midst of this three-year span, by the way. You know about how bad it was last year for Germany and the rest of the continent. 4 million over the course of 3 years. It's taking on about 1.3 million per year. Is that sustainable? Already, we're just starting the second year of that three-year window, that three-year prediction. And look at how many leaders, look at how many people in Europe are up in arms over what's happening in their nations, over what's happening on their continent. In the Times, this is from today, January 21, EU nations go it alone to guard against migration catastrophe. It says the European Union is on the brink of catastrophe. That's the German vice chancellor's warning. After Austria, it says, after Austria broke ranks to curb the number of refugees that it will allow to claim asylum. It says later in another signal that the migration crisis was worsening, the Netherlands admitted the existence of a plan B to the EU's asylum system and Schengen passport-free travel zone if the crisis continues beyond another 8 weeks. That's what some of the leaders are now saying. It's got to be solved by the end of March, or there's changes coming. We've got to go to another plan. The current numbers are not sustainable. We're running out of time. It says here in the article, Austria said yesterday that it would cap the number of asylum seekers at 35,500 this year, far fewer than the 90,000 who applied in 2015. It says, in a challenge to the Schengen system of open internal borders and a break with Germany's unlimited approach. And so now nations within the EU, they're going it alone until something gets solved in the Union. It says here later, President Gauck of Germany repeated his call for morally and politically necessary limits. He said in a speech at the Davos summit, limits are not unethical. They help to maintain acceptance within society. If Democrats are unwilling to talk about limits, then they will be leaving the field to populists and xenophobes. In other words, if we don't do something about this, then those far-right parties are just going to continually gain more popularity. And of course, there's quite a few articles that show that's exactly what's happening. I'll get to one in a little bit from the Los Angeles Times, talking about Germany's refugee crisis and how it's giving rise to the far right, calling this an ominous development. Let me first take you through this piece here that was translated by our news bureau. It's from the German publication, Süddeutsche Zeitung, from January 18th. You heard there, or I read to you, what President Gauck of Germany said about Germany's policy, its open border policy. There's also quite a lot of criticism aimed at Angela Merkel coming from the CSU, coming from Edmund Stoiber. This article from Süddeutsche Zeitung, it says former CSU leader, and I think he was the leader up to 2007, but he still has a strong role in the government, in that party. Former CSU leader Edmund Stoiber is demanding a complete closure of the border for refugees. A complete closure. Stoiber's got to be careful here. He might get banned from Britain. He's advocating a complete lockdown. And is, the article says, leaving the question open whether or not Merkel can remain chancellor. It's a pretty amazing article here. He was at a meeting. I guess this was a CSU meeting that Mrs. Merkel attended. And while she was speaking, he shouted, "You're killing off Europe! You're killing off Europe!" Now, she brushed aside the comment, trying to ignore it. But this is coming from an outspoken leader, the former CSU leader. Let me remind you what my father wrote in the latest Trumpet magazine. This has been on the website for several weeks now. He wrote this after the Paris attacks in November, saying that, I mean, even before that happened, you had many in Merkel's own party criticizing her openly. Many of her own political allies criticizing her openly, saying that she's got to do something about the refugee crisis. All of this is brought on by this prophesied clash, or at least the early stages of this prophesied clash, described there in Daniel 11. My father said in that article, where the Paris attacks are leading, that Edmund Stoiber's also attacking Merkel. And his party is part of her governing coalition, so she needs their support. Stoiber, of course, is the one that mentored Gutenberg, Zu Gutenberg. And so he's shouting now, right in front of Mrs. Merkel, "We've got to do something. You're killing Europe." Well, continuing from this Süddeutsche Zeitung piece, it says Stoiber wants to close the borders for all refugees, and with it, end Germany's solo effort. Only then, he believes, will pressure on other Europeans increase to the point that they will participate in a common solution in the refugee problem and not just wave people through to Germany. That's the way he sees it. These other nations closer to the border, the southern border, well, they're just letting them in. Well, some of them aren't now, but they're waving them through to Germany. The article here says Merkel must finally change her position, he says. Otherwise, quote, it will have disastrous consequences for Germany and Europe. He asked the CDU to act against Merkel if necessary. Will that not cause the fall of Merkel? Stoiber is professional enough not to answer this question and just somehow left it floating in the room. What do you suppose he's thinking? What do you suppose the CSU is thinking? What do you suppose many in Germany are thinking about this chancellor that a year ago was so popular in Germany, all across Europe, around the world even? We're witnessing some pretty amazing changes, and they're happening fast. This piece from the Los Angeles Times that I mentioned just a bit ago, Germany's refugee crisis turns it ominously to the right. This is the Los Angeles Times, concerned about the turn in Germany. For years, it's been an outlier in Europe. While far-right agitators gained strength in neighboring countries, including France and Austria, German voters stuck solidly to their traditional post-war parties. Chancellor Angela Merkel's center-right Christian Democrats and the Bavarian sister party, the CSU, managed to contain extreme grievances within a big unifying tent. No longer. This Los Angeles Times op-ed says, as Germany copes with an estimated 1.5 million refugees from the Middle East and North Africa, anti-immigrant sentiment is soaring. New political movements, massive weekly protests, and arson attacks on the homes of refugees highlight the nation's doubts and its divisions. It says later in this article, sound familiar? Just as populism is experiencing a comeback in America, so it's taking hold in Germany. But given the history of German nationalism, it inevitably has a more ominous tinge. Here again, drawing on some of the lessons from history, fairly recent history. Again, think about all of these events together, as Eric Wilson brought out in that Washington Times piece, worldwide unrest, instability. Those years leading up to World War II. This op-ed piece from the LA Times says, now the attacks in Cologne have crystallized those challenges and put Germans' doubts on worldwide display. Everyone sees it now. Ever since reunification, their nation has asserted itself in Europe, looking outward, ruling confidently. If it substitutes truculent nationalism for that brand of leadership, Merkel's dream of a united Europe will end. A continent bitterly divided by ethnicity will signal the return of demons Europeans thought they had exorcised long ago. Remember what Brad McDonald wrote just recently in the Trumpet? Those old demons are returning. It's as if some of these journalists are reading the Trumpet. They're probably not. But look at just some of the terminology that's now being used. Here's a piece in the Financial Times from yesterday titled, "The Holy Roman Empire Can Help Inspire a Different European Union." They know it has to be different. And now you have all these publications. Oh, this is a British publication. Saying that we need to look to the example of Charlemagne, of all people, to deal with these mounting crises. That's his title, not mine. The Holy Roman Empire can help us. It can inspire us here. We need something different. We need a plan B. Look at how fast these changes are coming. Can you keep up with them? It's a good thing we have a daily opportunity to run through this. It's a good thing we have thetrumpet.com. It's a good thing we have the Trumpet magazine, because prophecies are being fulfilled. What about 2016 and the inevitable recession, or worse, that we may experience? Well, okay, but what about 2018 or 19 or 20? History's repeating itself. Are you prepared for what's ahead? The Holy Roman Empire can help inspire a different European Union. The Financial Times says Germany's past casts a long shadow. Last summer, Greeks protesting against the stringent terms of the EU bailout brandished pictures of Angela Merkel sporting a Hitler mustache and a Nazi armband with a swastika replaced by the euro sign. Such images remain potent, but they hinder real engagement with the questions of how Germany will use its current economic and political influence and how far the EU can or should contain that power. For answers, we should look back in time to when Germany was part of the Holy Roman Empire. There are the answers, the way this individual sees it. Let's return to our roots. Let's return back to our history. Let's think about empire. Let's forget about the EU. Let's think about empire. And let's forget about the history following World War II. Let's think about Germany taking the lead. Let's think about Germany being more assertive. Well, that individual better be careful what he wishes for. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. That's Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm. Send us your emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
This morning I was reading through chapter 7 of Malachi's message on Prophesy Not, this chapter about God's people and the division over prophesying, warning this world, all these prophecies being fulfilled, as I said there in the first segment. And in reading that chapter, it was amazing to me just how well-positioned the Worldwide Church of God was at the death of Mr. Armstrong in 1986. And with all that was happening there in the late 1980s, the Soviet Union and its collapse, and of course the reunification of Germany. It had, I mean, if you think of that organization, the church, the Worldwide Church of God, it, for five decades, year in and year out, under Mr. Armstrong's leadership, through the Plain Truth, that monthly magazine, the World Tomorrow TV program, they had powerfully and consistently shouted a warning in love over the airwaves, in print, with those Plain Truth magazines. And that signature prophecy, as we've talked about so often before, was about a revival and reunification in Germany. It was about a revival of a Holy Roman Empire. That's prophesied. And so for five decades, there was Mr. Armstrong and his Plain Truth editors proclaiming that Germany would rise again, that Germany would be the dominant force behind this powerful union of European nation states, and that it would rise in power and surpass even Britain and the United States. Imagine prophesying that when Germany was ruined in rubble right after World War II. But that's what the Plain Truth did. And it continued right up to Mr. Armstrong's death in 1986, and Mr. Armstrong, of course, didn't live long enough to see the Berlin Wall come down in November of 1989, or to see Germany unite the following year. Look at how well-positioned the church was after he died to blast this earth with a message of hope, with the sure word of prophecy. But the thing is, within just a matter of a few short months, a year at best, after that year or so ended in the months that followed Mr. Armstrong's death, you look at that Plain Truth magazine and you see a very dramatically different tone, a different focus entirely. The magazine had been transformed. Here they were, all these earth-shattering events going on, and yet they had become lukewarm. They were blind to what was going on. Notice what they reported in their newspaper and in the Pastor General's report. This is from 1989, November 21. It says, following the spectacular news about the opening of the Berlin Wall, we unexpectedly received a call from a news station in Seattle. The news director was well aware of the World Tomorrow program and the fact that for more than 40 years, the church had been predicting the reunification of Europe in some form. He asked for our on-air comments about whether the church believed the opening of the wall was the commencement of end-time prophetic events. What an opportunity! This is a news station contacting the Worldwide Church of God. It was well aware of what the church had been predicting for 40 years. And it asked for someone there to give on-air comments. Is this the commencement of end-time prophetic events? Well, you can only imagine how Herbert Armstrong would have responded. But there were a lot of disturbing changes going on in that church after he died. Soon after he died, in fact, even before he died, really, as those Laodicean ministers were positioning themselves to grab power, to change doctrines, to water down the message, to water down the warning. You can go back and look at a booklet they produced in 1984, The History of Europe and the Church, and see that that booklet was full of all kinds of politically correct language that Mr. Armstrong never would have approved, but he was old at the time and nearly blind and obviously couldn't edit everything at that point in his life. And so the changes were already coming. The message was already being watered down. And then after he died in January of 1986, that same year, the WCG came out with an updated version of the United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book, as my father said there in chapter 7 of Malachi's message, this book that probably did more to build up the Worldwide Church of God than any other book or booklet that they produced. The United States and Britain in Prophecy. In chapter 7 of Malachi's message, my father says, next to the Bible, that book, it's probably the greatest book ever written on prophecy. And so what were those ministers doing after Mr. Armstrong died? Well, they were hard at work slashing that text down to a tiny little booklet, taking out a lot of its teachings, removing it from circulation. I could give you plenty of examples of the deceitful ways that they went about watering that truth down. Slashed to just a few pages, 40 or 50 pages in 1986. And then in 1987, it was removed from circulation entirely. From the 1989 PGR, this is going back to that exchange that they had with that news station in Seattle, Washington. The station manager called and said, we know what you've been prophesying for 40 years. Is this the commencement? Are we in the last days? Well, the PGR says we responded. This is the Worldwide Church of God officials. This was their response. We responded that it was premature to make statements like that. Hold your horses here, station manager. Don't get too excited about these events. Let's just tone down the enthusiasm. It's premature, really, for us to come out and take a strong position. It says later, the news director was disappointed that we would not proclaim this to be the absolute beginning of end time events. But it was interesting that he did say that what the church has predicted from the Bible was remarkably close to what appears to be happening. What a weak, tepid response. And longtime readers of The Plain Truth, many of them, noticed this obvious new direction that the church was taking. And after events like the Berlin Wall coming down and Germany reuniting, they had to be bitterly disappointed when they got those first issues of The Plain Truth after those earth-shaking events. As they started flipping through The Plain Truth saying, where is it? Where's the article about the Berlin Wall coming down? Where's the article about the significance of Germany reuniting? They weren't there. That magazine, that church behind the magazine had lost its vision. It lost its vision. It was no longer bold and courageous with its message. Instead, it was weak and timid and embarrassed, frankly, embarrassed. You couldn't go to The Plain Truth in 1989 or in 1990 or any year since to read about the sure word of prophecy. I mean, that's the way Peter described it. He said it was the sure word of prophecy. There is certainty in God's prophecies. That's why you can speak with such boldness and with clarity and conviction. So long as you stay grounded in the prophecies of God and let God and let the Bible interpret itself. Well, with respect to The Plain Truth, as you might imagine, readership plummeted. Subscribers, the number of subscribers plummeted. And then the publishers, after that, were facing a financial crisis as subscriber donations disappeared. Sad history. At one time, though, during its heyday, The Plain Truth, I mean, that was a magazine of vision. You can only imagine, as I say, what Mr. Armstrong might have said had he lived just long enough to see these events with his own eyes. This absolutely is the commencement of what the Bible calls the last days. He would have probably taken that newscaster or that station manager over to some of the scriptures that you hear about on this program or that you read about in our literature. Daniel chapter 2, for example. Let me just read a few verses here. This is the book of Daniel. You know about the leaders in the Babylonian Empire during Daniel's time and how that they came to him for understanding. They knew he was a man of God. They asked him for help in interpreting dreams and visions. Daniel 2:27, Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king?" But verse 28 says, "But there is a God in heaven that reveals secrets and makes known to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what shall be in the latter days. Yes, there is a God who knows. Yes, there is a God who reveals truth." Yes, there is a God who can make known to us what shall be in the latter days. Where are those ministers today? Those former editors of The Plain Truth today? Where are all of those researchers? Where is the news bureau that used to stay right up on top of all of those events? Where are they? Where's their voice? Where's the message? Where's the sure word of prophecy? Well, it's not coming out from that organization for sure. But that doesn't mean God is silent. God's raised the ruins. And you can find where God's voice is today if you're just willing to do a little bit of digging, a little bit of searching. There's lots of noise in the world today for sure. But you can get through to God's signal. There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. There is a God who makes known to us what shall be in the latter days. Continuing in verse 30, it says, "But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes, that shall make known the interpretation to the king." See, God reveals it. God reveals it in the pages of his Bible, his holy Bible, his inspired text. And he reveals it for our sake, that we might know what will happen in the latter days. Why would anyone want to turn away from that precious, life-saving information? Why would anyone just turn their back on that insider information? That revelation from God. That revealed truth. But that's exactly what so many people have done, tens of thousands of people. So many people that worked with the Plain Truth behind the scenes at the World Tomorrow program, printing booklets, answering letters, all of that mail, millions and millions of pieces of mail, and yet they turned their backs on the prophecies of God, and in some cases, even before Mr. Armstrong died. And well, as we've been covering these past couple weeks, even that, even their turn away from God, even their rebellion against God's government, even their falling away from the truth, even that, all of that is or was prophesied. God told us about it in advance. 2 Thessalonians 2, the book of Malachi, Zechariah 3 and 4, Revelation 3. They all tell the same story. That's what my father tries to bring out in Malachi's message, over and again with statements like that. It's the same story. It's prophesied. And God will make it known to you what will happen in these latter days. But the thing is, well, let's just look at this in conclusion. This is Matthew 11. The thing is, we have to have an attitude of a teachable child to be able to receive that truth. And then we have to have the courage and the faith to hang on to it, to hold to that truth once God gives it to us. Matthew 11 and verse 25, it says, "At that time Jesus answered and said, I thank you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hid these things from the wise and prudent and have revealed them unto babes." God reveals secrets to those who are teachable, to those who are spiritual babes, as it says there in verse 25. And look, we need those secrets. We need to know where all of this is leading. We can thank God that we do know, that we have his sure word of prophecy, that we have vision that we can see what's ahead, that we can see what's coming. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm. Send us those emails. Tell us where you're from. Tell us how you listen. TD@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.